Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with our program for today. Thank you. So I assume everyone is in the extension luncheon and we're having our lunch, so welcome. My name is Desmond Lane. I'm the Vice President for the Extension Division for ASHS, and we're grateful that you're all here today. We have an interesting program. I think what we were trying to do since we were in Hawaii was invite in two speakers, one who would represent Extension at the University of Hawaii and one that would represent a close industry partner and how they have worked together over the years to build successful programs, not only from an Extension outreach standpoint, but also to serve the industry. So I think we're in for a treat today. We have two speakers I'll introduce in just a moment. When their presentation is completed, we'll have a time of question and answer. And then the final portion of the program is we'll be presenting the Extension Materials Awards. So please stay for that. We'll be finished at 2:30. So we've got a full, hopefully, hour and a half here of things to keep us all busy. So let me go first and introduce the title of the presentation here is The Importance of Partnership for the Hawaii Floriculture Industry, an Extension and Industry Perspective. And our two speakers, Kelvin Sewaki, who's the Interim Associate Dean and Associate Director for Cooperative Extension at the University of Hawaii, and then Eric Tanoe of Greenpoint Nurseries. Did I get that right? All right. So Eric, I believe, is going to lead off, and they will sort of tag team and then take some questions at the end. And we look forward to their presentation. So thank you all for being here, and thanks right now, I guess, for our speakers.
Probably, I think you can probably just advance here, or even hit this here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe
do something
easier.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Desmond, and thank you all for being here. That was a great lunch. I always enjoy a salad. And thank you to ASHS for inviting me, because this is my first time attending your conference, and I'm really, really impressed. A lot of people I understand are here. Some of them are in the classrooms, and so that's nice. But I got a chance to go in the poster contest on the left side. I didn't get to the enough time to go on the right side, but I was really, really impressed with the posters, and how many posters I saw coming out of Hawaii. So that was even more fun to see. And now I know why Kelvin is so smart. Yeah. Well, aloha. And thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share a little about our family business and our industry. My name is Eric Tanoe, and I'm the president of Greenpoint Nurseries on the Big Island of Hawaii. And we are just starting our third generation in our family business, which was founded by my late father, Harold Tadashi Tanoe. Greenpoint is known for our anthuriums, and we export tropical flowers, foliage, and plants in the state, in the U.S. mainland, and some international markets. I also am the current president of Hawaii Floriculture and Nursery Association. HEFNA, as we call it in Hawaii, is a statewide umbrella organization that is made up of about 300 members. And the membership is a broad makeup of breeders, hybridizers, propagators, growers, shippers, wholesalers, retailers, educators, and the allied sector. Anyone in our Hawaii landscape that supports our industry in agriculture. I would like to believe that anthuriums are synonymous with Hawaii. Yet the story of the anthurium started long ago in the rainforests of South America. It was in the 1880s that anthuriums were brought to Hawaii by wealthy sugar plantation owners to adorn their landscapes and their estates. The gardeners of these estates were immigrants and originally brought in to work on the plantations. They were gifted these exotic plants by their employers, and soon anthuriums started sprouting in plantation camps and villages. Enterprising people saw business opportunity with these beautiful flowers and plants, and the cottage industry emerged and was born in about 1940s. My father's story began during college while attending Grinnell College in Iowa. It was too expensive for him at that time to come home for short breaks. And so during the holiday breaks, when he was abandoned, I guess, up in the mainland when school was closed, families of his schoolmates would invite him to stay with their families during short holiday breaks. And his mother, in return, would send boxes of anthuriums as thank you gifts to the hosts and hostesses. Their overwhelming reaction to these flowers, these anthuriums, probably most times, left a lasting impression on him. And being an enterprising individual he was, he saw the opportunity to ship these flowers as gifts and in commercial use from Hawaii to the domestic mainland markets. Thus, Greenpoint Nurseries was born, and this was in 1976. From its inception of our family business that has focused on innovation and technologies, this would not have been possible without our partnership with the University of Hawaii. Our company's history with College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources, CTAR, began in the early 60s when my father met Dr. Tadashi Higaki, a young and energetic extension agent. I would like to think they began their friendship because of their shared love of diversified agriculture, not to mention they shared also the same first name, Tadashi. He really helped my father. He really, really helped my father by conducting experiments in those early days to establish standard production practices. And I'm sure he would be proud that these practices are still being used today and applied today. I would like to share some of the challenges for our nursery and how CTAR has helped us and our industry solve and advance with some of our problems, yeah, that we've had. When my father first started in the anthurium business, the supply was limited and you cannot grow without supply. So we may as well start with talking about growing anthuriums. The floriculture industry was considered a category of diversified agriculture that didn't require prime agricultural land, that was offered, our sector anyway, was offered rocky, non-tillable land suitable, that was not really suitable for plantation production, but was available for us. At first, we experimented with a waste product from the sugar mills or the plantations that we called bagasse mulch. Bagasse, as we called it, was a fiber of sugarcane stalks after it left processing. But after 6 months of it decomposing, this material created a huge amount of mud. And as we all know, the organic decaying material attracts nematodes. And the detriment to the roots of the anthurium became a serious problem. To address this issue, my father experimented with volcanic cinder, pumice. We call it cinder. Working alongside Dr. Higaki, they ran tests, a lot of media tests. The plants thrived in this medium, and it's the standard medium today for cut flowers, blooming plants, and foliage plants, and landscape. In the early days, anthurium plants were grown also beneath natural shade. Large tree fern, we call them hapu, and citrus hammocks. The industry needed scale and to meet demand, and these methods proved not very feasible. With reading a national trade magazine revealed to my father a new material that he could import into Hawaii. And he was one of the first to import, as we call it today, shade cloth. They called it saran in those days. And so he built his first pipe and wire shade house. 5 acres were installed, and then a first windstorm came. It huffed, and it puffed, and it blew all the shade houses down. So Dr. Higaki next introduced my father to Dr. Harris Gitlin, an agricultural engineer at CTAR. He, with the planning and organizing of structural thought, helped build stronger shade houses that could withstand stronger winds. This shade house design would become another industry standard. Now, of course, the most important of growing anthuriums was the anthuriums themselves. Our first anthuriums came from my father going house to house, farm to farm, and seeking out plant material from private hybridizers. This led to us having some good plants and some not so good plants. With the new shade house technology, my father could focus on growth. Dr. Higaki introduced my dad next to Dr. Haruyuki Kamimoto, who today is considered the godfather of our anthurium and breeding, orchid breeding programs at CTAR. He laid the foundation that always allows our industry to remain competitive in the global market by creating new and exciting varieties. A farmer loves to share and talk story, as we say it in Hawaii, about the desirable traits that we have and want in our crops. For anthuriums, we need new cultivars, plants with better yield, fungus tolerance, anthracnose tolerance, cultivars with strong roots to support plants. And what we really like is plants that don't grow too big, too fast, because then the replanting becomes a problem for us in production. Dr. Kamimoto traveled extensively around the world to tropical, subtropical areas to collect anthurium species to begin his breeding program. Our industry has invested over half a century into this private and public partnership with CTAR. The CTAR breeding program has lived up to our expectations, bringing us great support with new varieties and releasing at this time about 50 cultivars in 50 years. Research and breeding are not the only source of support that CTAR has granted us. They have always helped us with marketing as well. My father started out exporting Inner Island and grew to shipping to the U.S. market on the West Coast. He met a colleague in the Bay Area who introduced him to another colleague in the Midwest and ended up meeting another colleague in Florida, which ended up leading to a sample shipment that was being shipped to Naples, Italy. Eventually, this shipment, these 200 dozens of anthurium, was shipped, and for a huge surprise to my dad of this trial shipment, the response came back with 2,000 dozens a week standing order from Naples, Italy. This was the first big boom for Hawaii growers and launched Hawaii into being an exporter to Europe. The first generation of anthurium growers were fearless, with the world eager for Hawaii's anthurium and other tropical plants. The industry went from 40 acres to 400 acres in a decade. Logistics and marketing started to become necessary dinner table conversations. And during the 80s, inevitable happens. The European countries like Holland started to become stiff competitors. Our products started moving to Japan. And in the 90s and 2000s, Taiwan became a competitor and entered the Japanese market. The Japanese market became too competitive, And so the industry started moving and focusing more on U.S. domestic markets. There were no exchange rates, and the freight or cargo was much more feasible. The biggest change, I would say, in logistics for our industry came with courier service like FedEx and UPS. It opened up the U.S. market and gave us the ability to ship door-to-door. We can ship now to any zip code from Hawaii in about 1 to 2 days in the U.S. market with a very, very reliable service. It became very, very feasible to ship small quantities of product, not needing a large distributor. So we, from 2,000 pounds, 200 boxes, you could go down to shipping one box to a zip code or a location. So we could get to customers like retail florist shops, designers, wedding designers, and even ultimately the consumer. Our industry formed associations like Hawaii Florists and Shippers Association, HFSA. This association grew from 30 members in sleepy little Hilo to over 300 members, and we had to go statewide and represent the whole state. This gave us economies of scale and allowed us to sign a mutual beneficial contract with FedEx, a contract that we've had successfully since 1991. In 1989, a new extension agent, Kelvin Sewake, was assigned to our industry. He was instrumental in growing our association and expanding our industry, not only with production, but with marketing as well. Then came one of the biggest challenges, blight. Xanthomonas, Axonopodis, PV, Diffenbachiae. It proceeded to cut our industry's production in half. This was the first time growers really got decimated. Our industry was in crisis. It took about maybe as long as 10 years, but with the help of Kelvin and Sitar, we were able to bring this debilitating disease under control. The simple concept of starting clean so you can end clean. The sanitation practice continues today as yet another industry standard. During this time, marketing became critical, very important. With the lower production, we really needed to find customers who could afford quality and pay for appropriate compensation for the quality. Kelvin helped us maintain that difficult balance of new production methods and new production coming in with finding new markets, new customers. He also taught the growers that were willing to learn, because not everyone is willing to learn, and we couldn't change all their minds, how to continue farming with this new challenge. Our extension agent was willing to coordinate a grower trip to Holland so our growers could see another side of production compared to only Hawaii. This trade mission proved very, very productive, changing the attitudes of our new emerging nursery men and women. I hope this history helped to illustrate that when we had the supply, we could move it. That is no longer true in maybe today's situation, for in this modern global era, we are faced with the reality of global competition. That is why it's more important than ever for us to have this support and relationship with Sitar. We need to have better production methods, incorporating new ways of growing. We need to compare ourselves, but more so prepare ourselves for climate change. We need quality products with the possibility with great coming out from great breeding programs. We understand that it takes about 12 to 14 years to develop a cultivar out of our breeding programs. And we need to be able to look to the future, and we know that Dr. Tessie Amore will be helping us create these cultivars for future endeavors. Dr. Amore is now overseeing our industry's breeding program at Sitar. We are glad to see researchers interacting with designers now and taking the steps to see flowers not just from a research standpoint, point of view, but from an artistic one. We believe this will lead to great cultivars in the future. We need to be able to understand new age or the new coming of age marketing, where the world is one world and social media is but a de facto way of communicating now. As an industry understand that we need to work together, and 10 years ago, we formed another umbrella organization called Hawaii Floriculture and Nursery Association, HEFNA. This way, we could combine our voices and be heard for the new challenges that we are faced with. HEFNA, in turn, helped to form another organization called Synergistic Hawaii Agriculture Council, SHAC, alongside with the Hawaii Papaya Industry Association and the Hawaii Coffee Association, two other statewide organizations, three coming together to form Synergistic Hawaii Agriculture Council. And by forming this, we were able to learn how to work with USDA Foreign Agricultural Service, FAS, to bring program money to Hawaii to help us do market assistance programs as well as TAS programs, technical assistance for specialty crops programs. But for marketing, the FAS programs that fund MAP took us to Canada. That was one of the countries that we all selected to go to for obvious reasons. Yeah? Calvin traveled with us to Canada on a trade mission, or a couple of trade missions actually, helping us to do research and look for those opportunities on how we could expand our markets in North America. I'd like to close by saying or sharing with you this saying that we have. Show me how much you care before you show me how much you know. Kelvin took the time. He attended many, many industry meetings and kept him up really late at night. Some of them outside of boardrooms. Some of them ended up being in bar and lounges to continue our meetings. But more importantly, he came in with the right attitudes. He showed us that he cared. He created a relationship of trust and mutual respect. And in the end, our success was his success. Our world is always changing. We know this. But we must change with it. Having science in our toolbox is vital, but with partners like CITAR, we can continue to share the beauty of Hawaii's floricultural and ornamental crops with the world. So I'd like to say to Kelvin and CITAR, thank you.
Right. Thank you very much, Eric, for the that presentation, and which pretty much goes over somewhat of the history of the floral industry in Hawaii, and especially as it relates to Eric and Greenpoint Nursery and the interim industry. For myself, I am serving now as the interim associate dean and associate director for extension for CITAR, which is University of Hawaii at Manoa. So I'm located in Honolulu now, where I was for the first 30 years based out in the Hilo office, but for the last 2 years now have been up in Honolulu. CITAR stands for College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources, so that you can understand that acronym. My background basically got my 2 degrees from UH CITAR, my master's back in 84, and then my work experience right after I graduated. About 5 months later, I started working in the Hilo office in the Cooperative Extension Service as a agent for Hawaiian Homes lessees. And that's a program where all the crops, whatever the Hawaiian Homes lessees grew, is what I was responsible for. But my clientele were Hawaiian homesteaders, Native Hawaiians. I did that for about 4 years roughly. And then in 1989, I started working with the floral industry. And worked with the floral industry for pretty much the next about 26 years straight, and still currently as administrator, I still work with Eric and his groups. They never took me off of their email list, so I get all of their emails. They keep me pretty much well informed and try to involve me in their activities, which is great. I love it. Within that period of time, there were a couple of year period where I did serve as a Hawaii County Administrator and oversaw the programs in the Big Island here. Currently as the Associate Dean, though, I do have responsibility over all extension programs statewide. And that is not only the agricultural programs, but the human resources side of our college involve those programs such as the 4-H programs, the food and nutrition programs, intergenerational programs, and those types. So when you look at how long I've been associated with our college, it's been a long time. It's been about maybe 39 years total as a student and then as an employee. So I have a lot of history with the college, which is great. And I love every minute that I've been there. Okay, early on when I got into extension, this is an old photo, probably back in 1986 or something. I know I changed my looks a little bit since then, but I really give credit to the people that I started working with in extension. And if any of you have been working in extension programs, I think you would know how extension is. And we are like a family. One of the things that, I was 25 years old, okay, and I come into extension, and we talk amongst each other, our high school classmates, we get together, what are you doing now? What do you like about your job? Do you like your job? And I would tell everybody, yes, I love my job. And the best thing about it is we're like a family. So when you see their extension, Ohana is sort of it's the Hawaiian word for family. We really call it, this is our extension, Ohana. And I think of all the people you see on there right now, there's only one other person beside myself who's still employed. Everybody else is long retired. But I give my credit on learning the foundations of extension. The extension methods, but not only that, but more importantly, the philosophy of extension and service to people in the community is really what extension is about. The heart and soul of extension, to me, is that we are public service. We are providing public service to our stakeholders and our community in order to improve as much as we can in those communities that we do serve. So I give a lot of credit to them. So I want to thank them. Looking at a floriculture industry, I've been always interested in floriculture. My master's work was in floriculture. And because I always looked at floriculture as one of the industries that I always thought that had very good potential in Hawaii, because floriculture commodities or crops are very high valued commodities. So when you look at the history of the floriculture and nursery industry in Hawaii, we've had a very good record of growth, steady growth, 2-3% a year. This graph here shows about 45 years of wholesale value of sales going back to 1970. But even if you look beyond that, before that, for the last 50, 60, 70 years, you would see the steady increase in growth. What you see on the graph in the 1990s, that little dip there is because of the recession, right? The Gulf War and recession. So everybody kind of takes a hit economically. But the industry was able to rebound, and the floriculture industry kept growing until about 2007, when $108.7 million in value was the highest on record. And then, as we all know, 2007-08, with the huge recession, then our value of production has dropped. But it is starting to come back, and we worked on marketing efforts more recently to try and improve that situation. I'll talk about five different things that kind of categorize in larger categories that I'd like to talk about, where extension, I feel, has worked with industry very closely. One thing that extension agents do a lot of is crisis management, firefighting, those kind of things, right? Problems occur all the time that we need to address. But when I stepped into this industry in 1989, this Antirrhinum blight disease that Eric talked about was really running rampant. The Antirrhinum industry, being the largest and oldest cut flower industry that began, as Eric mentioned, pretty much after World War II, rose to be the number one industry. And at that point, when I came on, it was really being devastated by this disease. And so there was a lot of effort that needed to be put forward in order to address that. The disease was first found in around 1970 on the island of Kauai. And in 1980, it got over here to the Big Island. And most of the farms, pretty much, 98-99% of the production was here on the Big Island. And so it really devastated the industry a lot, where we lost 3.4 million plants within an 8-year period. And production, when I came on board, was dropping 15 to 22% per year of decline in our production, and it was heading straight down to rock bottom. So industry went from 435 acres grown by 235 farmers down to 220 acres by 120 farmers when I came on board in 1989. So I jumped into the fire, in other words. Industry was really having a hard time with disease. What we needed to do was basically work together very collaboratively with many of our partners. HEIA was the Hawaiian Theorem Industry Association that lobbied and worked very closely with our college, UH CTAR, worked very closely with UH Hilo, because we have a University of Hawaii at Hilo on the Hilo side, our Hawaii State Legislature, and the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, in order to get funding support. And they were very successful in lobbying and able to get $6 million total over a number of years to provide research funding for looking at interim blight. And so at any given time during the year for a several-year period, we would have 15 research projects for interim blight alone. It was a major industry for us. It required a lot of attention. So HEIA basically, in working with the association, stated their needs, you know, in extension we always look at what are the needs of the industry. They did the legislative lobbying, and they were very effective lobbyists, even meeting in the governor's office. The Department of Ag, HDOA, and the Hawaii State Leg, of course, provided the funding. One of the programs that they provided was for emergency loan program, where in my assistance with the interim industry, we looked at collecting information on blight and the devastation to the industry so that we could put forth that information to the governor. We met in the governor, John Y. Hayes' office, and we did request for a declaration of disaster that would then open up emergency loans from the Department of Agriculture, which would be low interest, 3.5% interest loans for the farmers to continue farming. So we were able to get that kind of funding, that kind of program going through the state departments of agriculture and state leg. From the university standpoint, we're looking at the research and education. So again, a lot of different programs going on. On the educational part, when I came on board, what I saw was this. You know, I came on board when the industry was dealing with this for 9 years. There was a lot of work that was already being done at the time I came in. And knowing that it's a bacterial problem, I figured that it's probably going to be sanitation and what it's all going to boil down to. And so my job really was to educate the growers on sanitation procedures. And it was really bad at that time when university was getting hit, because industry wanted to have that silver bullet. What is it that we can spray on this disease and just, you know, it goes away? Just knowing some basic, on basics on trying to control bacteria is very difficult. I thought the main thing I needed to do was to change growers' attitudes. You know, part of extension is changing attitude, knowledge, skills, right? And then before that, we do that, then we hopefully change behavior. So what I did at that time was I developed a video, which in those days was quite a bit of work. It's not like today. Everybody, you know, everything's online today. But back then, video production was pretty intense. But what I did was I looked at, because I had the opportunity to visit all the interim farms, Greenpoint included, and see the practices that you're doing, and they're actually working. But nobody else in the industry could see that, because nobody wanted to visit anybody's farm, and they didn't want people to come on board because they didn't want to spread the bacterial disease around. But I was able to see the different farms that were doing great, and I featured 4 farms on a 70-minute long video. I think people here, like, I see Bill here at UH Hilo, he remembers that time. Bill was involved in the interim blight days. You know, at a conference at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on our second day of the conference, I figured 170 people in the audience would be falling asleep, but not a single person fell asleep. They watched this 70-minute long video on interim blight control. And after that video, it was incredible to see the change in attitude. When they saw that 4 growers are actually having good control by doing all the sanitation procedures, they themselves started to look at, like, well, I guess the onus of responsibility now is on my shoulders. So it's up to me to do it for my farm. And that kind of turned the perception around, and then growers started to then implement the practice. The other thing I noticed as I went to individual farms was everybody said, yes, we're following the university recommendations. So I said, okay, can you show me what you do? Do you dip your shears? Yes, I dip my shears. Can you show me how you do it? Okay, they dip their shears, they cut, they go all the way down a 100-foot row, they turn around, they dip it again, and they come back. So I say, okay, every cut you have to dip, okay? Do you pluck up the infected flowers or leaves and throw them down? Oh, yes, we do. I mean, do you get rid of them? Yes, we do. So can you show me that procedure? So they would pluck off the leaf that's infected and throw it in the bed. You know, because that was common practice back then to do that, because antirrhinums were so hardy, you could just throw them around and they'd grow. So we make these very fine, points of information, I guess, you know, practices that weren't really being done. But as they did that, then they started to get a lot better control. So, you know, in a few years later, by 1992, when we looked at the Department of Ag statistics, the production decline bottomed out. And from 1992 on, you would slowly start to see production coming back again. You know, unfortunately, we had lost almost half the growers at that time. But now that they were fully aware of sanitation procedures and they were doing it, they found out, you know, that they could get good control. Sanitation was the key, and still today is the key. We're using different ways to look at interim blight because it's still there, ever-present, so we have to be on guard. But the interim industry started to come back again. So that was one of the main major programs that I've worked in as far as crisis management. Another area that I think is important and that we've worked in, I'd like to give this example, is development of government programs, where we work with our partner agencies, Hawaii Department of Agriculture, along with CTAR, and the California Department of Food and Agriculture. In the 1990s, when the recession again took place, Department of Ag California was also very much strapped for their quarantine inspectors. So how can we develop a program that would be beneficial for California, CDFA, and for Hawaii and our growers? The idea of an origin inspection program had come about, where our individual shippers from Hawaii would be pre-cleared to ship product into California if they're on an approved list of shippers. So working very closely with California and Department of Ag, CDFA and our Hawaii Department of Ag, we looked at different nurseries that were very clean nurseries. They all came down. We visited the nurseries, did a thorough walkthrough, found out what they were doing to provide a very high level of cleanliness. And these certain nurseries were put on this program. So for about an 8 or 9 year period, this program existed. And as we went through year after year, involved in this is really from the shipper's part, kind of trying to control insect pests in the field. And also after they are harvested, a lot of different steps were required in order for them to be an approved shipper. So that included things like washing the flowers, and they'd have to wash every single flower. If you see here, like this one photo on the upper left, it's a red ginger. And if you know what the red ginger bracts look like, it's very difficult to get in between to clean aphids and thrips and scales. But they have to power wash that. Visual inspection as they go through the process of cleaning, inspection at the time of packing, and other steps such as using insecticidal dips, which these different post-harvest treatments were being tested by our extension specialist, Dr. Arnold Hara, who did a lot of work on insect control. And for our orchid growers, we're expecting them to use field monitoring and surveying using a Berlesi funnel technique, where you would put in these dendrobium orchid blossoms into this Berlesi funnel, which is basically an automotive funnel with a screen that holds the flowers, a light source on the top where the heat would drive the thrips down into alcohol jar on the bottom. And then they could count the number of thrips. And that way, every week they can do counts and then use those counts to determine when they need to go in and spray and things like that. But a lot of these steps were implemented in order to have the products as clean as possible, because if you know California, California has a zero tolerance on pests. So we couldn't allow anything to go through. Dr. Arnold Hara also developed this hot water treatment, which you see this basket here with red gingers in, where the flowers are dipped, tropical flowers are dipped into hot water. It's roughly more or less 110 degrees for about more or less 10 minutes, depending on the crop itself. And it would kill everything from insects to adults. And so in following this program, this program really had a lot of good results in that it ended up with very clean shipments, and through random inspections by CDFA, We never got any rejections in the 8 or 9 years of the program. It allowed for the expeditious movement of products because they're not having to inspect every single box now like they did before. And so it was very good for the shipper. It was very good for the consumer because they get the product to them very quickly. And so there were a lot less consumer complaints and things like that. So, excuse me. So this is a program that is, you know, a program where government agencies have come in with extensions help, industry help, and where we're able to come up with a very good program where there's a win-win situation. The other thing that I think is important for extension is really to support industry associations. And as Eric mentioned, you know, there's been a lot of late night meetings, and I don't know about the other stuff at the bars, but but certainly night meetings that took place at night, and we had a lot of organizations to deal with. But in one situation, Eric mentioned a bit, is the FedEx National Account Agreement, where Hawaii flower shippers, in order to ship their products out to the mainland, obviously have to go air freight to get fresh product out. And, of course, you know, those air freight rates were high for us. So back in 1990 to 91, the Hilo Florists and Shippers Association worked with FedEx company very closely to negotiate a deal for discounted freight rates to domestic and international markets. And as Eric mentioned, at that time it was a Hilo Florists Shippers Association. They had about 50 members when I came on board, and it was declining. But working with the association and the with FedEx company, we were able to really improve the situation, offer this kind of program to the shippers. And I remember going into one of the first meetings we had. We did statewide educational meetings on this. And there were 200 shippers that came to this meeting room. And everybody walking in told me, "Kelvin, it's not going to work. Nobody's going to offer us that great of a deal." I said, "Well, we'll see. You know, let's see what happens in this meeting." By the end of that night, people are walking out the door telling me that's the opposite. "Sounds like a good program. I'm signing up." So within 2 weeks, we went from, I think, 50 members to about 200 members within 2 weeks. Membership applications were flying in. And because that program has been so successful, it's still being conducted even today. And Eric, as the president of now the Hawaii Floriculture and Nursery Association that has taken over, I guess it's a testimony to the success of the industry working with a company like that. And they continue to enjoy discounted freight rates. Again, supporting industry associations, I think it's very important that Extension does that. I do that because, to me, the industry associations represent the large industry. When they speak on behalf of what are major issues for that industry. So as an agent, you know, you get a lot of different problems to resolve because the agents were jack of all trades, right? There's so many problems, so many people to deal with. But the industry associations will point out what is their industry-wide problem. So some of those problems that we've worked on would be marketing and branding efforts. As you can see, Hawaii grown on the orchid sleeves that the Hawaii orchid growers have developed to try and put our name out there as far as branding. These are micro-perforated sleeves which all the dendrobium sprays go into and flower sprays go into. And that was developed, and these boxes that you see on the bottom were developed by our Hawaii Tropical Flower Council, which was really the generic marketing organization that was made up of four different commodity groups at that time. And I remember doing this box program. It took us how many years, Eric? 2 years just to get the colors right. I mean, you know, everybody was arguing on a board, like, what colors should we make this box? And this is what it ended up to be after, I think, 2 years of monthly meetings. But it's all good. In the end, it works out good. So this is how we try to market generically. And then to further that, you know, as an agent in floriculture, across the state, there were probably about 14 different flower associations. And every association differed by commodity. Anthurium Association, the Orchid Association, the Tropical Association, the Protea Association, and then we have all of our counties that have their own chapters and their own individual groups. Anyway, about 14 individual associations, and my night meetings were attending all of these meetings, and that's why, for myself, I thought, you know, we ought to unite somehow. And that was my dream when I first entered this industry, going to all of these night meetings. It's about time we unite. So I don't know, it probably took 20 years later or something that when we finally started, I spoke to Eric, and we started to pass word to the industry associations about the idea of uniting under one umbrella organization. It took us, after strategic planning meetings, like this one here, with all the representatives from all the different 14 groups, Farm Bureau also came on board and some of our other CTAR people. After this group of representatives from all these organizations met monthly for 5 years, so we had at least 60 meetings, right, Eric? Until we finally formed this Hawaii Floriculture and Nursery Association, which is the umbrella organization that Eric talked about, that has, it had grown up to about 360 members, I think, at its peak. But this is the organization that really does a lot of the communication and a lot of the funding. They represent us in legislature and all of those things. So it's a group that has been really good, really great to work with this group here. And the last thing is extension works to try and develop our leaders. I wish I could have spent more time, honestly, in this area, because we always look at leadership. We look at, you know, who's going to run this industry as we're getting grayer and losing hair and stuff like that. But we do work with industry leaders. We try to develop them. And through the working with leaders in our organizations, we've tried to develop that. CTAR also has an Agricultural Leadership Foundation of Hawaii leadership training program, and we've graduated dozens of agricultural leaders who contribute to agriculture in the state of Hawaii today. And so Eric Tanoi, I'd like to say, is really one of our shining stars. As you can see the list, and this is just a partial list of the things that he's been involved in. President for HEFNA, VP for Hawaii Florists and Shippers Association. He serves on the County of Hawaii Agricultural Advisory Committee. He sits on our Dean's Advisory Board. He was a CARAT member for APLU, for University of Hawaii. And out in the business world, he was a president of, KIAA, Kanoi Lehua Industrial Area Association. So Eric has really been, one of our leaders that has developed over time. So I had to put this picture of him when he was at a much younger age. But you look at him, he still looks the same. He's still got all his hair, and his hair is still black and all slick back. I don't want to put my phone in there because I'm all gray and bald already, you know. But Eric hasn't aged a bit. But you know, our college recognized him in our awards banquet in this year in April. And he was named the CTAR Kale Hano Award recipient from our college for one of the outstanding community members and stakeholders that has provided so much to the industry, to agriculture in general, and to his community. So in that, you know, he has been a very, very excellent partner with CTAR over all these years. And so, you know, just finally, the, key components, I think, in a true partnership, it's a lot of this. And I'm sure you can extend this list even further. But as Eric said, and as I would say, trust, respect, caring, those are the kind of things that are really human values, you know. So if we come in with that kind of mindset, that kind of philosophy, that kind of value system, I think for extension folks that we can work with industry very closely and develop this kind of partnership that really will take us a lot farther than anything that you can do. You know, you take these values, you put, you know, all the right people in place, and things click. Communication, commitment, mutual benefit, growth, understanding. And at the bottom there, celebration, yeah? So celebrate your successes with your industry folks. And that's what we like to do. We like to honor them. We like to celebrate with them. Extension service in Hawaii, just to put a plug, next year will be 90 years of extension in Hawaii. And so I'm planning a big celebration, and it's going to be the 100th year for 4-H programs in Hawaii. So we have two different things going on next year. So 2018, you can look forward to that coming from Hawaii. But again, I'd like to thank Eric and the industry and his leadership there and the partnership from the industries. I'd like to thank Desmond for inviting us to speak, and thank you to Desmond and ASHS for inviting us up here today. So it was my pleasure in speaking to you all. Thank you.
That was awesome. Thank you so much. We have probably 10 minutes or so for Q&A. So if any of you have a question for either of our speakers, I'll ask them both to come back up and be happy to address any questions that you have. And so if you would please repeat the question, because this is being recorded. All right? Thank you.
Kathleen.
Well, the question is, how is climate change affecting us on the Big Island or in the state? And so, yes, we do notice, whether it's weather change or whether it's climate change, whatever you want to call it or whatever you believe, there is a pattern that we're going through. We're seemingly having warmer, hotter days. In Hilo, we have about 120 inches a year. So we measure rain in feet in Hilo. So, but even if we get 25% less trade wind days, which cuts us from 120 down to 90, fortunately for the east side of this island, we're still okay. But we are seeing from the weather patterns, because we're getting hotter days, we're seeing new fungus, and maybe Kelvin might help me there, but we just identified with diagnostics a new anthracnose. I don't know if it's mutating or it's something new coming in. So we're really fighting with pesticides. And unfortunately, the first means of defense right now for us is, what's the pesticide we got to use? What's the fungicide, right? Another thing that we're seeing is, we never had Trips palmi on anthuriums before. Now it's hosting on anthurium. It always used to stay on orchids. We see Trips palmi now attacking our anthuriums now, which is, we need pesticides again, yeah? So it's just creating, even if we try to do sanitation, because we have forests all around our nurseries, it's airborne, it's blowing in possibly. So we're probably looking at having to use more fungicide or insecticide in that area. The heat also, in anthuriums, I'm not the expert here, but I've been told anywhere from 80 degrees to 83 degrees Fahrenheit. As our heat goes up, anthuriums slow down. So with the higher heat, we're having to address, do we lift our buildings? Do we change the shade, put more heavier shade? Can we pulse irrigate more to cool the crop down? So all of these things we are attempting to do now. We noticed, though, our shade cloth is seemingly not as cool as it was before. Yeah, it seems like it's hotter in our greenhouses and shade houses. And in Hawaii, we also have what we call a free air system. So normally most of the greenhouses in Hawaii or in Hilo on the Big Island, we don't heat or cool. We basically build the structures to take advantage of our trade winds. So when you have good trade winds, you have a cool building. But when you have less trade winds, then you have a hotter, warmer building, which encourages more insect and disease activity. Yeah? So these are just some of the things we're experiencing. So I think one of the long-term ways we can address this is possibly with research. We're really looking at research to help us with some of these problems, and we have some Big Island researchers that are right on the middle of the table. So they're really helping us out right now with research right now to try and address some of these problems. Yes.
In my state, local flowers have become a very big source of demand. Are you seeing more demand for local flowers here in Hawaii?
Definitely. Yes. The question is are local produced flowers, like locally grown, yeah, Hawaii grown, becoming more popular in the state? Yes. The answer is yes. We have been participating with county and state grants on a buy local, it matters campaign, and also an import replacement campaign. We've been doing this for about 5 years now on the front end. On the back end, we've always promoted buy local. We've always promoted support your local grower or your local small business, but not in the way that we're using the import replacement program, which is basically what it says. We have already a pent-up demand. So if the growers right now just grow what we are importing, you have an automatic demand. You can get young growers, young farmers, new business to come in and produce because you don't have to import it. Yeah. But on the other hand, what really is helpful with this buy local and import replacement programs is that I think the consumer today is becoming really, really well, way more informed, and that you know, whether it's 50-mile plate or 50-mile bouquet, you know, it's trying to use what is produced locally to satisfy your needs. It's just whatever the cliche is, lower your carbon footprint, burn less barrels of oil. I think it's just good for the community. The other thing we've noticed is, you know, Hawaii has a lot of farmers markets now. We never had farmers markets before. You know, people had maybe a roadside stand, but we never had really functioning farmers markets. I think that's extensive, I think, throughout the U.S. now. There's farmers markets all over. And the consumer today, I think, trusts the farmer that's at the farmers market that they buy from. They become friends personally, and I think that encourages getting that relationship and getting an understanding of the product you're purchasing at the farmers market. I think the consumer feels more connected with the purchase, with the product, and the farmer that way, rather than nothing against mass market or supermarkets, but the farmers don't hang out at the supermarket, yeah? So it's a very unemotional, impersonal transaction, whereas at a farmer's market, it's very personal, yeah? So I think for all and more reasons is why I think local product is going to become a stronger purchase. I think it's going to drive more economy locally in our local communities. It's good for small business.
Yes.
You want to take that? I think that was.
So your question is how the Hawaiian, the Native Hawaiian home farmers are being affected by. Okay, so is the agricultural economics of Hawaiian homes going up with what's going on in the agricultural? Oh, okay. Are Hawaiian home lands farmers making more money? that's a very straightforward question, difficult to answer. The program with the Native Hawaiian Farmers, as part of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, when a farmer gets, a Hawaiian Homes lessee gets a lease, they have a few years in order to produce on, I think, something like 2/3 of their acreage. In the past, the Hawaiian Home Farmers would get 20 acres, and when I came on board, they started giving out lots that were 10 acres in size, and then they kept decreasing, 5 acres, 3 acres. Because what they found was that most of the Hawaiian homes lessees were not able to do that. We're not able to meet that and be compliant with the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. So the current thinking with the current administration is to provide more what they're going to call subsistence farm lots, so that they're going to be smaller in size. They're talking about that right now. Their planning department, their directors are discussing the size of a subsistence lots. Today you hear about more small farms, you know, a lot of people going to just small farms, being more subsistence or supplemental income kind of farms. And I think that model that would probably suit them better. Because most of the times, as far as my experience, and this is my personal take on it, is when I was in the program, I think a lot of them needed a place, they needed land so that they could, you know, they could farm, but they could build their home and a place to call their own. And that was really, I think, a lot of the lessee's intention. You know, because a lot of them maybe did not have the resources that they need in order to, you know, build up a full-fledged, full-scale farming operation. And there's a lot of obstacles to that. The Hawaiian Homes Department does have a contract with us, university, and where we hire an agent that's involved in providing educational programs. But that's just one thing that we can provide to them. And yet they have many other obstacles getting the funding, getting the resources. You know, for them, oftentimes they may not have the financial ability to put into a large-scale farm like that. So for a lot of them, if they stayed to a smaller-scale subsistence type of farming operation where we could teach them the basics, we could teach them basics about, you know, maybe their crops that are more culturally appropriate for that community, and have them grow. Now, if they are interested, if they're doing a good job in doing on a small scale, subsistence farming, then the Hawaiian Homes program, could offer larger, acreages for those that maybe pass that level. But then at least people will be in compliance. They'll be able to put more people on the land. There's a lot of these issues that they're talking about right now. So in the past, it's been a real big challenge for us to get them to where we can say Hawaiian Homelands lessees are making money. You know, but, you know, I need to say that since the time that I've been on board, they've opened up some farmers markets and things that have helped some of the Hawaiian Homes farmers in actually selling product. And we have some pretty progressive farmers out there right now that are doing very good work on this island. In fact, there's one company that is really Hawaiian Homes based that are doing a great job in growing tomatoes and things like that. So there are success stories too, but when you look at the total number of farmers, 600 that I was dealing with when I started, and there's a lot more now, we have a lot to go in that direction. But I'm very excited about being able to work with the Hawaiian Homes Department again. And it kind of, it's coming around, you know, after 30 years, I'm back working with them again, and I'm very familiar with their situation. So they're kind of involving me also in their planning and looking ahead and trying to develop these kind of, you know, a situation that would work. So they're going to start their first model here on the Big Island. They're looking at starting it up next year, 2018. They're in the planning phase. They're discussing with their community groups. We had a statewide agricultural conference 3 weeks ago where the afternoon of the second session was devoted to homesteaders, fill up a room, and they gave their input as far as what they thought they needed for something like this. So there was a lot of good discussion, and the Hawaiian Homes Department now is taking that back for consideration in their future planning process. So I'm hoping that we can make headway and create some other new model that might be working even better than perhaps some of the models in the past that met with some, you know, pretty limited success, I think. But yet there's, you know, efforts that were there, and there were individuals that have done well in it. But, you know, to try to move the whole group of them forward, it's going to take a lot of effort. But we're moving to make more improvements as we can. Thank you. Yes.
So the question is, with industry and sitar, are we considering diversifying our crops and moving to non-traditional crops? Right now, marijuana is still illegal on a federal level, so we're not considering marijuana right now. that's a good question. I think not on a point on marijuana, but on diversification. Our import replacement program is leading us down that road right now. We have small grants that we're getting from County of Hawaii as well as State Department of Ag that help us invest in import replacement. And basically, it's doing good research with CTAR's help to identify what crops we can grow, do demonstrations on the experiment stations. So we're working with Maui right now, and then we're looking at the Big Island for next year to try and put plots in, planting plots of different crops where young farmers or existing business that want to diversify and grow something different, they can go into. So actually, when you really think about it, that sky's the limit, yeah? You can grow anything here. It's just what you want to grow, what do you want to do, yeah? And a lot of times, that's where maybe we can get help from Kelvin in this area. Because extension, we can bring in other people, other resources, yeah? From the 4-H groups can also be very involved there, too. Because we can start from a young age, yeah? To start exposing them to new crops. A lot of times, we don't have the expertise. So with CTAR, they would probably be able to source the expertise on this type of level and bring speakers and experts to Hawaii to maybe help us do the demonstration plots.
Thank you.
So yeah, that's a very exciting area for us.
I know we're running out of time, but just one comment. So, you know, our college right now, we have a new dean who started September 1st. And, you know, he asked me the question, how many breeders do we have in our college? And where we had more breeders before, we're down to, I think, probably two breeders left. So, you know, his emphasis is looking at, we need to have more breeders, you know. So as we can develop that part of our college, the breeding, you know, we may be able to look into a lot of other alternative ornamental crops and things like that. But we do have a program, as Eric mentioned, in which we are looking at that. We have a project in which we'll not only look at that and try to get some import replacements, but we're going to look at propagating it locally. We got a $500,000 grant from the State Department of Agriculture. We have 3 years to move on that project to get plants back to industry, and we're going to be developing a tissue culture lab to do so. So with that, you know, we'd like to take in, you know, whatever other kind of alternative ornamental crops and other crops that we can work with to supply for our local industries.
Yes, thank you to our speakers. Gentlemen, that was excellent. Thank you so much. We're going to conclude our program today with our awards section. So when Kelvin was finishing up talking about celebrating, this is an opportunity for us to celebrate excellence among our peers. So each year we have nominations for Extension Materials Awards, and we have a review committee that reviews those nominations and comes up with a list of recommendations for presenting these awards. So I have the privilege of making these presentations now. And all the awardees, there's going to be, we're transitioning from a regular monthly newsletter at ASHS to every couple of weeks having an email blast. But I'm going to be preparing an article that will speak about what happened today, and it will identify all the awardees who received awards today. And I think in the future we're going to try and publicize this a little bit better so that it's actually in the program, and so that we'll even provide links so that you can go and see what those resources are that won awards. So we'll try and do that for next year. But each one of these awardees, some of them are here. If they're not here, I will just send the certificates to them. But I wanted you to realize that we have different categories of awards. So we have books, we have websites, we have fact sheets, we have videos. And they had to meet a certain criteria that was established by the evaluation team. And then the top performing ones were the ones that we chose for awards. So I'm going to walk through these. I'll announce the award and who it is. And if you are here, please come to the front to be recognized. And then I have printed and signed certificates to give to whoever will be here, and then you can send the rest to your teammates if they're not actually present here, because some of these have like 10 people on a big team. So we'll begin first off with the 2017 Outstanding Book Award. And so this is the Extension Gardener Handbook, and the authors are Kathleen Moore and Lucy Bradley from North Carolina State Extension. So... Next, we have a 2017 Outstanding Bulletin Award, and the title of this award is Collard Greens in Common Ground, a North Carolina Community Food Gardening Handbook. And the authors are Don Beckelheide, I don't know, is it close enough, and Lucy Bradley. Don is with Central Piedmont Community College, and Lucy is with NC State. So, congratulations again. There you go. Well, you better stay up here because it looks like you got another one. Okay, we have a 2017 Outstanding Website Award, and this is the North Carolina State Extension Gardening Portal. And so Lucy Bradley, Rob Ladd, and Mike Vysoka from NC State Extension. So.
Oops, sorry. There you go. Congratulations again. There you go. All right. They obviously have an awesome program at NC State. So next we have 2017 Outstanding Video Award. This is Rutgers Ultra Niche Crops Virtual Field Trip, High Tunnel Winter Lettuce. And there are, I think, 10 authors here, but I'll name them. There's Robin Brumfeld, Jenny Carleo, Hemant Gohil, Ramu Govindasamy, Jeff Heckman, Daniel Kloshinsky, Jennifer Matthews, Meredith Melendez, Jess Nieder, Peter Nietzsche, Nicholas Polanin, C. Andrew Weinendent, and Fred McGrady. So you have a big team.
We do.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, next we have 2017 Outstanding Leaflet Award, and this is a leaflet entitled Squash Bug, and the authors are Raymond Cloyd and James Neckels from Kansas State University. Is anyone here from Kansas State? Okay, well, I will make sure that I send this off to the authors when I get back. Next, we have the 2017 Outstanding Fact Sheet Award. This is for growing vegetables in Central Oregon. Amy Jo Detweiler, Liz Duville, Vicki Kemp, and Tony Steffen at Oregon State University.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you. 2017 Outstanding Fact Sheet Award. This is entitled Hydrangea Production Series. PB 1840-A and PB 1840-B from University of Tennessee Extension. James Owen of Virginia Tech, Amy Fulcher of University of Tennessee, Anthony Laboud at North Carolina State University, and Matthew Chappell at the University of Georgia. Anyone there from here from that team? All right, please. And next we have the 2017 Outstanding Bulletin / App Award. So this is both a bulletin and an app. It's entitled Cherry Training Systems. And this is another, as we've seen already, a multi-state effort, which is awesome. Lynn Long from Oregon State University, Greg Lang from Michigan State, Stefano Mazzocchi from Washington State University, and Matt Whiting from Washington State University. Congratulations. Our next award is for the 2017 Outstanding Website, and this is the WSU Tree Fruit website. And I believe none of the team members are here, so I'll be sending this to them, but I want to identify the members of the team. Tom Avil, Rob Blakey, Daniel Blyle, Tiana DuPont, David Granitstein, Inez Hanrahan, Gwen Hoheisel, Wendy Jones, Lee Kalsitz, Karen Lewis, Jim McPherson, Josh Paulson, Tori Schmidt, and Tim Smith. So, WSU Tree Fruit website. A 2017 Outstanding Book Award. This is for Penn State Extension Master Gardener Manual. Authors are Nancy Naus, Jennifer Baer, Amanda Kirsten, and Sue Weibel. Don't know if I messed those names up. Okay, you're here on behalf of them? All right. One more? All right. Very good. Thank you.
Next, we have a 2017 Outstanding Leaflet Award. This is short duration cover crops for vegetable production systems, A.J. Nair and Raymond Cruz from Iowa State University.
And you're AJ. Very good. Well, better stay here. Yeah, I got another one for you. And then this is a 2017 Outstanding Fact Sheet Award entitled Crop Rotations, Composting, and Cover Crops for Organic Vegetable Production. Kathleen Delott and A.J. Nair of Iowa State University. Okay, thank you. So that concludes our awards presentation. I would just like to encourage all of you, whether you are the originator of some great content or you have colleagues who've generated some really great content that relates to extension that could be considered as a nomination for awards in the future, please let me know. We have a formal nomination process, and we're eager to have recommendations of excellent materials, of which all of these today represent that. So you're free to stay and mingle a little bit more. We've got this room until about 2:30. But if I could have one more just round of applause for our invited speakers, and thank you for coming.